Hello there. Today is Tuesday, December 18th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. denies that the president's giving in to Turkish demands to extradite a self-exiled cleric living in the U.S. A new report finds the scope of Russia's meddling in U.S. democracy goes much deeper than thought.
Most of the Russian strategy is things that we've seen before. It's really focusing on widening already existing divisions in American society.
Peace talks between the U.S. and the Taliban are continuing. Also ahead, is a move to protect African elephants putting them at further risk? It's all on today's International Edition. The White House is denying Turkey's claim that President Donald Trump is thinking about extraditing wanted Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen back to Turkey. Turkey's foreign minister said on CNBC television that Trump told Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan that the U.S. is working on extraditing Gulen and other people. Gulen is living in self-imposed exile in Pennsylvania. Turkey accuses him of orchestrating the failed 2016 military coup against Erdogan. Gulen denies the charge, but Turkey has demanded the U.S. turn him over. The Turkish president also said Monday he has the support of Trump on a situation in northeastern Syria, where Turkey is threatening to launch a new operation against American-backed Syrian Kurdish fighters. Turkey is vowing to launch the new offensive on what they describe as a terrorist group. And also connected to Turkey, an ex-business partner and another businessman with ties to the Turkish government and Trump's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, have been charged with disclosing lobbying efforts aimed at the extradition of Gulen. Flynn's former partner was indicted on two criminal counts, including conspiracy to act as an agent of a foreign government. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Michael Fishbach, history professor at Randolph-Macon College in Ashland, Virginia, about this complex story between two NATO allies.
To say that they've been strained and complicated in the past 2 years would be an understatement. For all their similarities, President Trump and President Erdogan have some real serious difficulties, and they are rather multifaceted. And so the talk about extraditing Gulen from Pennsylvania is really part of a much wider web of concerns. Certainly there is Turkish threats to invade east of the Euphrates River in Syria against the Kurdish YPG, largely Kurdish YPG forces. There's also clearly another dimension or two, and that is the Turks released an American religious figure, a pastor, quite recently, and I think there was an assumption of quid pro quo. Hanging yet more prominently is Turkey's visceral anger at its otherwise erstwhile Sunni ally, Saudi Arabia, over the murder of Jamal Khashoggi in Istanbul, and the fact that President Trump, even in defiance of his own Senate, has refused to do anything really serious against the Saudis and mollify the Turks. And of course, there's always other regional things going on. Israel has discovered some tunnels in southern Lebanon that Hezbollah has dug under the border between Lebanon and Israel. And of course, Hezbollah is an ally of the Syrian regime. And so any Turkish efforts in Syria are also going to involve some kind of arrangement with the Syrian government, and that involves Hezbollah, and that involves Israel, which in turn involves the United States. So there are a number of aspects, policy relating to everything from Saudi Arabia to Israel to President Trump's actually own former advisor, that fit into this complicated question of what is or is not going to happen as far as Fethullah Gulen and any talk of extradition.
Turkey's foreign minister, Cavusoglu, on Sunday said the president told Mr. Erdogan on the sidelines of the G20 in Buenos Aires that the U.S. was, quote, working on extraditing Gulen and other people. Gulen, a former ally of Mr. Erdogan, now an enemy. Is this all about a vendetta against an individual, or is this something truly about the attempted coup in Turkey?
You know, that's an interesting question. Certainly, I think your listeners should be aware that Gulen and Erdogan were former allies, that in many ways they come from the same kind of religious and mixing of religion and politics, that same impulse. And they had a falling out a number of years ago. But it's not to say that ideologically that they come from two different corners of the universe. And so there is a personal dimension to it. But it's been hard to ferret out, even 2 years now after the attempted coup, to find out what, if any, influence Gulen really had over this coup and the plotters. But regardless, it's certainly the response of President Erdogan to crack down on just about anybody accused of anything has fueled speculation that his campaign is directed at much more than simply Gulen's supporters. But it really remains, to me at least, quite murky what, if anything, Gulen did have to do with the attempted coup. But certainly there's been bad blood between those two for a while now. And again, that in part has stemmed from the fact that they used to be rather close allies.
When Turkey first demanded the extradition of Fethullah Gulen after the attempted coup some 2 years ago, there was a high bar that had to be met in terms of offering up evidence to link him to the attempted coup. I'm not sure that that bar has been met.
Well, certainly the United States, the State Department has insisted over the years that it is not. Now, with all due respect to the Trump administration, to say that it's chaotic is an understatement. So there certainly has been friction, notably when Rex Tillerson was still Secretary of State, between the Department of State and the executive branch. But certainly it has not been felt, I think until this very hour, that the Turks have provided enough direct evidence. Because there is a long-standing tradition in this country of separating people who are wanted for extradition who had committed what's called them civil crimes versus those who are wanted for political motive. That's involved in the past decades, everything from Irish suspects that the British accused of being in the underground IRA to Palestinians wanted by Israel. And so there's been a rather high bar, as you suggested, about not wanting to extradite people who are just political opponents of regime X or regime Y, but in fact have clearly committed some kind of crime. And I think that that's still in evidence here. And the State Department, frankly, has not been convinced that the Turks have met that standard.
Well, if he's not extradited, what happens to U.S.-Turkish relations, in your view?
Well, that's a problem. I think, in fact, Erdogan intervened to have this American pastor relieved, very obviously hoping for quid pro quo. You a religious leader back, you give one to us. Certainly, there's been other things going on that have angered the Turks. And I think this recent threat to invade northern Syria, which potentially endangers American special forces, there are about 2,000 of them in northeast Syria, is clearly, I think, an effort to put pressure on Trump, not only to release Gulen, but I think it's also releasing Gulen would be seen as, or potentially from Trump's point of view, a way to get the Turks to back off on insisting that Washington do something vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia. So I think the Turks have a strong hand of cards here. The extradition does not happen. I'm not quite sure what we can expect, frankly.
That's Michael Fischbach, history professor at Randolph-Macon College in Ashland, Virginia. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Democratic Republic of Congo voters want change, and they want it now. U.S. airstrikes destroy an al-Shabaab base, killing 62 militants. Syrians look to Christmas without mortar fire. And no sign of ending funding stalemate to avert a partial U.S. government shutdown. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A just-released report from the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee shows Russia's sweeping political disinformation campaign on U.S. social media was far more reaching than originally thought. Russia used every major social media platform to target voters with misinformation to try to get Donald Trump elected president. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
The reports show Russian agents shifted their focus to Instagram after the public became aware last year of the widespread manipulation on Facebook and Twitter. Also, Russian agents tried to polarize Americans in part by targeting African-American communities extensively, by calling for boycotts or following the wrong voting procedures. The researchers wrote, Russia got little diplomatic or other pushback, so it's likely Russian interference will continue, with troll farms still working to stoke racial and political passions in America. Facebook, Google, and Twitter declined to comment on the specifics of the report. Ed Donahue, Washington.
Well, joining us now to discuss more in depth is Elizabeth Bodine Barron, an information scientist with the RAND Corporation. What exactly is your initial takeaway from this unbelievable report?
So the reports go into far greater detail as to the actual posts and engagement that happened on the variety of social media platforms, including Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and others. The original set of data that was released was focused almost entirely on ads, specifically ads that were purchased on Facebook. The new reports go into the entire media environment and some of the personas that were created to engage with specific audiences.
Why do you think this went so deep and so far-reaching?
So part of it is one of the goals of any propaganda campaign is to reach your target audience and engage with them where they are. So if you're targeting different segments of a population, then you're going to be reaching them on the platforms that they're interacting on. So if you've got a young population that's primarily acting on Facebook and communicating on Facebook, you're going to try to reach out to them there, whereas if you're reaching a different audience that might primarily be, say, watching YouTube videos, you'd want to engage with them where they are on YouTube.
The report also indicated that the activity actually increased after the election. Why would that be?
So I think what happened is that we're able to identify some of these accounts more. Some of the specific tells, whether it's using some Russian language or paying for ads in rubles and things like that, we're seeing more and more of that. So part of it is that we're getting better at detecting it. There is, however, an arms race where when we publicize, oh, we can now tell that this is a Russian troll, then they stop doing it, so it becomes more difficult. So there's a back and forth there. But basically, despite the fact that it became publicized, they kept doing what they were doing. Some of the activity did shift. So, for example, some of the activity shifted from Twitter to Instagram, perhaps because Instagram wasn't as publicized, whereas the Twitter posts really were.
I heard some analysis that much of what the Russian trolls were trying to convey, the information, the derision, the disparagement, was mirroring some of the things that the Trump campaign was saying.
Most of the Russian strategy is things that we've seen before. It's really focusing on widening already existing divisions in American society and sometimes simultaneously posting stories taking the exact opposite point of view on a particular topic or an event, posting them literally simultaneously on two different channels to create more and more controversy and more division. So what you're seeing was not only Black Lives Matter, but also Blue Lives Matter, and some of the debate about police violence and things like that. One of the particular things that these reports exposed was the degree to which the campaign also focused on voter suppression, specifically of African Americans.
And we just learned today from the Washington Post that the Russian disinformation teams targeted Special Counsel Robert Mueller in the Russia investigation itself soon after his appointment, trying to create a question as to whether it was, in fact, a so-called hoax.
One of the strategies that we see is that they're targeting Western democratic institutions and the democratic process, and the goal is to cause people to lose faith in that democratic process, whether it's that their vote won't matter or that no one cares about them and there's no point in voting, things like that, but also any sort of cultural divide. They'll take an existing division and just poke at it and push really extreme narratives on both sides to try to get people to be even further apart.
You know, I heard someone say this is equivalent to sort of an undisclosed political war against the United States. Does this seem to corroborate that we really are in full-blown information warfare?
I would say so, and I think that's one of the conclusions that is coming out of this report, is that this is an aspect of information warfare that is likely only to continue, and I wouldn't call it undisclosed. I think it's fairly out there in the open for anyone with the data and the tools to see it.
And my understanding is it's happening in other democracies, as you mentioned earlier, you know, like many in Europe. At least in this country, it's not clear what we're doing to stop it.
Right. So there's certainly a lack of coordination that we're seeing when we try to approach this issue, partially because it's so complex of an issue, especially in light of Western and U.S. values when it comes to things like freedom of speech. So you have to have cooperation between social media companies and government, academia and research institutions and policy experts. But at the same time, you want to be able to identify what's going on, be able to call it out when it is disinformation or misinformation, deliberately targeted disinformation, you know, for a specific purpose meant to deceive. But at the same time, you have this balance where we have this value of free speech. And so you don't necessarily want social media companies being the regulators of free speech. So the question is, you know, how does the law adapt to this new changing media landscape?
All right. Elizabeth Bodine Barron is an information scientist with the research and analyst nonprofit RAND Corporation. Thanks for being with us. Peace talks involving U.S. and Taliban officials took place in the United Arab Emirates Monday. The talks were organized by Pakistan. Government officials were not immediately available to discuss details of the meeting. Ayaz Gul in Islamabad, Pakistan, told International Edition's Sarah Williams about what's known about the discussions.
Well, what we understand as of this moment is that the dialogue has concluded in United Arab Emirates, which basically hosted today's negotiation. And the significant thing about this dialogue is that, yes, Pakistan organized it, and especially honoring a request from President Donald Trump, who wrote a letter to Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan earlier this month that he wanted Pakistan to encourage the Taliban to engage in some kind of a constructive dialogue, because we know that U.S. Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad has been meeting with the Taliban in Qatar since July. But so far, no progress has been achieved, and U.S. believes that Taliban leaders are sheltering in Pakistan, and Pakistan has some kind of an influence over the insurgent fighters and leaders, so the country should push the Taliban to engage in a peace process so that this deadly war in Afghanistan could be brought to an end. And that is why Pakistan was asked to play its role, and Pakistan did manage to bring the Taliban to the table in a way for the first time in 4 years that representatives of the Afghan government were also sitting in the room, although the Taliban just clarified a little while ago in a statement that they directly spoke to the U.S. and they had no engagement with Afghan officials present in the room. And that clarification has been issued because the Taliban has consistently refused to engage in any kind of dialogue with Afghan government or any Afghan internal dialogue, because they have maintained for long that the U.S. and NATO forces have to withdraw from Afghanistan before any intra-Afghan dialogue can take shape in the country and the Taliban would participate in that dialogue. So the bottom line is that it was the first time in 4 years that the Afghan representative, Afghan government representative, Taliban officials were sitting on the table, but the U.S. was trying to convince, what we understand, the Taliban to stop fighting, stop this bloodshed, and try to find a resolution of the conflict through a negotiated or through a peaceful process.
But considering the depth and range of the issues to be decided, one day hardly seems long enough.
That is absolutely right. A good point you raised, because for the past 40 years, we have seen this conflict in Afghanistan going on, and that has created so much divisions and so much hatred among even ethnic groups against the Taliban within other ethnicities in Afghanistan, that it is very difficult to have some kind of a process in place in the near future where hostilities could be stopped. But it is widely believed that because Taliban fighters who have managed over the last 3 years or 4 years to take control or extend their influence to nearly half of Afghanistan, that if they stop fighting, the rest of the issues of domestic feuds and tribal feuds could be overcome. But it is the Taliban, which is the main force in terms of the insurgency going on in Afghanistan, that is being encouraged and convinced to stop fighting. But the challenges are so daunting that this one meeting would not achieve anything. But once the Taliban agrees to engage in a peace process, the immediate hope is that there will be at least temporary cessation to hostilities in Afghanistan, because so many people have been killed over the past 3 years in Afghanistan, we understand from a recent study that nearly 150,000 people have died since the U.S.-led invasion of the country happened 17 years ago. And even this year, we have seen unprecedented increase in battlefield activities and insurgent attacks, that this could be one of the worst years in 17 years in terms of casualties inflicted both on Afghan government forces and civilians.
All right, that's VOA's Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, friends. This is Sunday Shomari Hostel. Let's talk. Join me Monday for another exciting edition of your show. Our topic will be superstition. This will be Monday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa,
around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. All the candidates running for president in the Democratic Republic of Congo are promising to fix the nation's ailing economy and spread the country's vast natural wealth to its people. But after years of corruption, a crumbling infrastructure, and failing services, voters doubt that Sunday's poll will bring the change that they seek. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Kinshasa.
Lundu Kumba Kidioko doesn't care who wins Congo's hotly contested election on December 23rd. He just wants what all the top candidates have promised, a better life in a resource-rich nation riven by high unemployment and a shocking lack of basic services. He charges $5 for a haircut and shave when he can.
We have a serious problem with electricity. Every day we have an outage from around 10 a.m. and it doesn't come back until 5 p.m. or even 8 p.m. This is a hardship for us, and we want permanent electricity.
But he counts himself lucky for having a job. Many of his customers, like this man, are unemployed, and emigration is rising as Congolese citizens seek opportunities outside of the country. We asked both of the main presidential camps how they will tackle economic challenges. Ruling party presidential candidate Emmanuel Ramazani Shadari wants to increase government spending and also reshape the resource-reliant economy, his spokesman said.
His main idea is to make an open and multi-economy. You know, we say that our economy is based on copper and minerals. We want the economy to be diversified.
Opposition candidate Martin Fayulu, a businessman and former oil executive, told VOA he plans to run the massive country like he has run his successful businesses, by making the nation more attractive to investors.
We want to elevate the poverty of Congolese. We want to give them a job. We want the people to see that Congo destination for business should be one of the first destination, one of the first choice, and then we establish the the relation in between. How can we discuss to manage the country?
At the barbershop, things are far more simple. Kumba Kidioko complained of basic problems, lack of water, high unemployment, poor infrastructure, and said he's tired of political promises.
I'd ask the authorities who are going to come into power to meet their responsibilities to the country.
Or, Kumba Kidioko says, he might take a stab at the messy world of politics.
I love politics. Maybe one day, if I get the chance, I'll embrace a political career.
But for now, he says, as the election approaches, he'll stick to working with people's hair. Anita Powell, VOA News, Kinshasa.
At more than 1 hectare under one roof, Bronner's Christmas Wonderland promotes itself as the largest Christmas store in the world. Erica Celeste visited the store in Frankenmuth, Michigan for a tour through the eyes of some of its smallest customers, children.
Wow, this is really neat.
Wow.
Visiting Bronner's Christmas Wonderland is more than a shopping trip. It's an experience. At roughly the size of 8 Olympic swimming pools, it's a lot for siblings Rollin and Rain Martorello to grasp.
It's huge. That's all I can say. It's really huge.
A trip to Bronner's often starts with a commemorative photo. From there, customers are given a map to help navigate the store. Dazzling lights and outdoor decor cascade from the ceilings that had to be raised to accommodate the taller Christmas tree displays. Rollins says he likes the old-fashioned Dickens characters, Christmas villages, and nutcrackers that cover the showroom floor. But the modern electronic displays are the best.
My favorite thing is the moment turned on.
We have over 50,000, just over 50,000 items here. Everything from artificial trees and wreaths and garlands, all kinds of lighting, the LED lights. We have ornaments. We have about 8,000 styles of ornaments. About 1,500 of those can be personalized.
In fact, says Media Relations Chief Lori Lipka, the ornaments are the stars of the store. Everything from hand-blown glass baubles to sports-themed pieces and even movie motif ornaments. A definite favorite are the international ornaments, which makes sense because the store guestbook reflects visitors from more than 100 countries.
We do see a lot of international folks, and it's not unusual to walk around and to hear several languages being spoken any given day this time of year.
Founder Wally Bronner was a teenager when he started a sign painting business. After a businessman asked him to create Christmas signs for the city of Clare, Michigan, he recognized a niche market and in 1945 opened a store specializing in the holiday. Because his faith and family were important to him, Bronner worked tirelessly to blend the religious meaning of Christmas with the commercial aspect.
Hi, Rollin.
Hi.
He also made sure Bronner's was a place for customers of all ages to enjoy. That's why young customers who need a break from shopping can visit with Santa.
You know, I like being at Bronner's because it gives me a chance to really talk about what Christmas means. You know, and I give out one of those little ornaments that has Mary and Joseph and the baby Jesus.
Because the store is open 361 days a year, it's the one place kids of all ages can get a little Christmas anytime they want. For VOA News, I'm Erica Celeste in Frankenmuth, Michigan.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.